From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
Sheldon Harnick is one of America's greatest lyricists. His career spanned more than 50 years. He co-wrote with Jerry Bock the music for Fiddler on the Roof, Fiorello, and She Loves Me, among others. He's won 2 Tony Awards, a Pulitzer Prize, 2 Grammys, 2 New York Drama Critics Circle Awards, 3 gold records, and a platinum record. That's quite a list. And he is now in his 80s. But that hasn't slowed him down much. On April 8th through the 10th, he will be co-hosting the 92nd Street Wise Lyrics and Lyricist program. I'm very pleased that he was able to come to my show today. Welcome, Sheldon Harnick.
Thank you.
Now,
I have slowed down.
You have? You don't look it.
It was inevitable.
You've pretty much always collaborated, but wasn't there a time when you actually wrote the music as well?
Well, I started writing my own music and my lyrics, and the first song I had in a Broadway review was a song called The Boston Begin from New Faces of 1952, and that was my own music. And then I had a song called The Merry Minuet.
Songs based on dances.
Yes, yeah. Along the way... By the way, my god when I came to New York was the lyricist Yip Harburg. Mm-hmm. Somebody gave me an introduction to him. I played for him, and he said, I think you're very talented. And then he said, in my opinion, there are more capable theater composers than there are theater lyricists. So if I were you, I would also write with other people. He said, I think it'll facilitate your career.
Obviously, he was telling you weren't Irving Berlin or Cole Porter.
Well, I learned that the hard way.
So who was your first music partner?
After myself, it was, I just remembered who it was. I can't remember his name, which is a good thing. He was a wealthy young man, a dilettante, and he had a project which I really didn't like. He had gotten the rights to a book, but he gave me a very handsome advance. Well, he had a style of piano playing that I've never seen since. When he had set one of my lyrics, he'd invite me over to the house, and he would go to the piano, and he would put his hands down on it, and it was as though he had hit a red-hot object, because he would immediately withdraw his hands. So he'd hit a chord and then immediately pull his hands away, and it made me very nervous. I began to wish that the project would dissolve. And actually, there was a book writer who said at a certain point, this is not going to work, and we went our separate ways. But then I met a wonderful composer named David Baker. And as a matter of fact, we did a show off-Broadway in 1961, I think it was. It was called Smiling the Boy Fell Dead. It was not successful. But I just, out of curiosity, about a year ago, I went to my files to see whether I had anything. I had 4 different scripts, and each one had wonderful stuff that was different from what was in the other scripts. So I just combined them all into one script using everything I've learned over the last 40, 50 years, and I gave it to my wife to read and said, be brutal, what do you think? And she read it, and she said, it's charming. So this may come back to life, and that has music by David Baker.
And do you like the songs?
Yes, very much.
So when did you start working with Jerry Bock?
We met around 1956. I met Jerry through a good friend of his, the performer Jack Cassidy. Jack had been in a failed musical, a version of Shangri-La. I was called in to try and help with lyrics, and I met Jack. And Jack wanted me to meet Jerry Bock because Jerry had just split up with his composer, and he was looking for a new lyricist. So we met, and Jerry's publisher, a man named Tommy Volando, he did a piece of legerdemain. I don't know how he did it. He persuaded a producer, Richard Colmar, to use Jerry and me. We had never written together, but he picked us to do a show called The Body Beautiful. Unfortunately, it was a show about boxing, and I really don't care very much about boxing, but once again, it was an opportunity I couldn't turn down.
Do you know when you start working with a composer that this is a good team, or does it take a time,
a while
to develop?
It takes time. I knew enough of Jerry's music to know that I liked it. He had written Mr. Wonderful, and actually the lyricist he broke up with subsequent to that had written with him. And there was at least one song from that show, Too Close for Comfort, which I thought was just wonderful. So I knew Jerry's work. When we met and started to work together, we were very delicate with each other, because it was my experience that at the beginning of a collaboration, you take everything personally. It takes a while before you can be objective and say, well, he doesn't like the lyric. It's not that he hates me personally. So that took a while. But right from the beginning, I was very comfortable with Jerry for an odd reason. We did not get together in a room and work, as, for instance, Candor and Ebb do. Jerry had a way of working. I've never worked with anybody like that. When we knew what the source material was, he would go into his studio and work on a musical number that would fit a certain situation or a certain character. When he had developed it to a certain point, he'd put it on tape. Then, and I would be off in my studio reading the material, looking for ideas for songs. At a certain point, Jerry would send me the tape, and it would generally have maybe 8 to 12 numbers on it, each one prefaced with a sentence, well, I see this is for the boxing manager, I see this is for the girl. And usually the most interesting songs were the one that were prefaced with, I don't know what the hell is, but I like it. So on every tape, there would be at least one or two songs that fit with an idea I had and also were exciting to me musically. Also, as you can imagine, when you have the music, you don't have to worry about creating the form. It's there. So, and happily, I'm a very good musician, so I was able to write to these to this music.
But you did have to figure out how to get the words to fit the music. Sometimes you got a lot of words and only a few notes. So there had to be a certain amount of understanding in advance from him that you were going to either tinker with it, or an understanding from you that you were going to have to really adjust things.
It's part of the lyricist's job to put words to music and not change the music. What you can do, sometimes you can introduce a pickup note, just a note that lead into a phrase, but almost invariably, you leave the music alone.
So when you wrote, did you write Fiddler on the Roof that way, Fiorello?
Yes. As a matter of fact, after Jerry and I split up, I got very curious to see how many times the music came first and how many times the lyrics came first. So I made a list of all the songs we had done in the shows, and as best I could recollect, I went through it and was kind of surprised to find out that it came out 50-50. Usually what happened was that at a certain point, I had an idea for a song, but I didn't want to be constrained, which is what you're saying. I didn't want to have to cram all these words into a very narrow space, so that I needed the freedom to write, especially if there were going to be several verses, because each verse might have to be recarpentered so that it had the same metric construction as the previous verse.
Well, this is something that has to have gone back to the earliest musicals. In this event that you're doing at the 92nd Street Y, you're presenting songs, not your songs on the whole, other people's songs.
They're none of my songs.
And one of the examples is going to be Gilbert and Sullivan. And I've often thought about how some of those really complicated lyrics wound up being put into songs. Did did the lyrics get written first and then music adapted, or do you know if they sat in the room together? Obviously, he didn't. There were no tapes exchanged.
Up until they had their big fight, and then they wouldn't sit in the same room together. As I understand...
Well, let me give an example, okay? Let's play something.
Oh, okay.
And then you could talk about it. And obviously the music and the lyric work perfectly together there. You would have thought somebody like Irving Berlin or Cole Porter would have done it.
It's my understanding that Gilbert was not a musician. However, I seem to remember reading that he said what was necessary was not a musical sense, but a very refined sense of rhythm, and that he had. As I understand it, he wrote all the lyrics first. And what Sullivan did was to set them, and if Sullivan needed changes, he would ask him for them, and Gilbert would make the changes. Sometimes Sullivan would repeat phrases. He would change perhaps the running order of the phrases in order to serve the music. But those people who don't care for Gilbert and Sullivan, one of their complaints may be justified. Because all the lyrics came first, Gilbert tended to get into certain patterns, and some of the music tends to sound too similar.
And there were some times when he just gave him so many words to work with. Another song about a gentleman, which just there's no way I can even try to quote it, but it goes, it's very, very quick patter. Those patter songs must have been very difficult to compose melodies to.
I imagine they were, and that's one of, I think, the extraordinary things that Sullivan was able to do, to find wonderful melodies to match those words.
Do you see them as precursors of what you try to do?
To a certain extent, yes. Stylistically, no, although every once in a while I have tried to make my little homage to them. There's a moment in Fiddler, which nobody knows, is my salute to Gilbert. It's in the dream. But who is this? There's when just before Fruma Serra appears, I wish I could remember the line, but there's a line that is very Gilbertian in its structure, and I thought that's my subtle salute to Gilbert.
I'm talking with Sheldon Harnick, who will be co-hosting Lyrics and Lyricists at the 92nd Street Y on the 8th, 9th, and 10th of this month, along with Rob Fisher. He'll be exploring some of the lyrics and lyricists who have influenced him and whom he admires. And we will continue our conversation and look at a few of those right after this.
Gray skies are gonna clear up, put on a happy face. Brush off the clouds and cheer up, put on a happy face. Take off the gloomy mask of tragedy, it's not your style. You look so good that you'll be glad you decided to smile.
That's one of the hit songs from Bye Bye Birdie by Adams and Strauss. Now, they're contemporaries, aren't they?
Yes.
So did you go to other people's musicals and say, oh my gosh, I wish we had written that? Or did you just hear things that you felt as a fan that you could relate to?
When Rob Fisher asked me to do this program, it was actually a spinoff of something that Steve Sondheim did about 3 years ago, where he made a list of songs by other people he wished he'd written. And then somebody did a concert of many of those songs. Rob thought this would be a terrific idea for Lyrics and Lyricists, to have a professional lyricist pick out 20 songs or so and then explain what it was about those songs that he liked. So I was very flattered when he said, Sheldon, I'd like you to be the lyricist. Mm-hmm. And the one that was just played, Put on a Happy Face, that was one that came to me immediately because it has one of my favorite rhymes of all time. And it's in the release that you just played. Put on the happy, put on the mask, now I'm blocking on lyric, but the rhyme is the mask of tragedy. And then it's, you'll look so good, you'll be gladgedy. You'll be glad you decided to smile. And the notion that somebody would rhyme tragedy and gladgedy, that's wonderful.
And I suspect you've heard other things where you thought, gee, that it was just such a brilliant solution to a difficult problem.
One of the songs I'm using is, let me go back. Some years ago, I was invited to try to make a musical out of a little book called Children's Letters to God. These letters, they're very short and they're very funny and sweet and naive. I said yes because I thought the book was so charming, and I couldn't solve it. I couldn't find the way into that material. And years later, a man named Stuart Hampel, who was one of the compilers of the book, invited me to a version that they had. I went. The lyrics were by a friend named Doug Cohen, and I thought, I wonder how he solved it. And he solved it by looking very closely at all those very short letters and looking for hints which indicated that there was a real underlying problem which could then be expanded. So there's one song we're doing called Silly Old Hat. It's a wonderful song about a little boy who was yelling at somebody, don't touch my hat. I know it's a silly hat. And then you realize that his father gave it to him and that the family got divorced. You know, so that was an admirable lyric.
Now, you mentioned Stephen Sondheim. He is one of those people who went in the opposite direction, started off writing lyrics, and then decided to write his own music, although I'm sure he always wanted to write his own music. And you've chosen one of his songs to talk about. Maybe we can listen to a little of that.
Black sable one day, next day it goes into hock. But I'm here. Top billing Monday, Tuesday you're touring in stock, but I'm here. First you're another slow vamp, then someone's mother, then your camp, then you career from career to career.
The great Elaine Stritch singing I'm Still Here from Follies. Now, Sondheim actually started, as you did, writing both the words and the music, and then had the opportunity to work with some of the greatest composers of his time. But after a while, did return, and has been a major influence on everything that's followed.
Oh, he's a wonderful composer. He's a brilliant composer as well as a brilliant lyricist. The snippet that you sang, that is a long song, rather complicated song, and it turned out that the two girls who are doing our show did not have the time to work on it. So Rob said, Sheldon, why don't you do this song you did a year ago? There was a birthday salute to Steve at the Symphony Space, and I had been asked to sing a song from Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum called Free, which I did, and so I'll be repeating that.
But also great lyrics. He is one of the cleverest lyricists that ever lived, don't you think?
He's extraordinary. Yeah, extraordinary.
Try to remember the kind of September when life was slow and oh so mellow. Try to remember the kind of September when grass was green and grain was yellow. Try to remember the kind of September when you were a tender and calm.
From the Fantastics, one of the longest-running musicals ever, wasn't it?
Yeah, some 40 years.
And that's an extraordinary song. When you listen to the lyrics, you realize just how clever it is. And I didn't know there were that many rhymes you could do with September.
That's the song. When I did my program a year ago, I was told that one of the most pleasing parts of it to the audience is the sing-along. So we had a sing-along, and I was thinking, what song can we use this year for the sing-along? And I thought that would be a lovely song, not only because people know it, well, that would be very important that they know it, but also because, as I will point out to them before they sing it, there's so many little joyous details in it, the alliteration, the assonance, the fact that one of the words that's prominent in it is follow. And as I will tell the audience, the two most singable vowels in our language are ah and oh. So follow has both of them. It's very satisfying to sing.
Do you think that because Jones and Schmidt were kind of outsiders, that allowed them to be fresh in a way others might not have been?
Well,
wasn't Harvey Schmidt an art director or something?
Harvey, yeah, he was an art director. He's a polymath. I don't know if that's the case. We're all outsiders when we start. And, you know, this was maybe 45 or 50 years ago. I've forgotten how long it's been since Fantastic closed. They came from Texas. And Tom is an extremely educated man. He knows the theater literature. When they first wrote the show, I believe it's an adaptation of a play by Russ Dunham. And when they first wrote it, I saw it, and it didn't work. And I commiserated with Tom, not knowing that he was going to find a way to fix it. It was going to run 40 years.
The next one is from a movie. You've done a fair amount of composing for movies.
Some, yeah.
But nothing perhaps as memorable as this.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving.
Well, I don't think we have to play much more of that. Everybody knows that song by heart. Candor and Ebb, and Extraordinary.
That's going to be my closing number.
Is that a particular favorite of yours?
Yes.
What is it about the lyric there that grabs you, other than the fact that everybody remembers it?
I'm not sure. That's my answer. I do think that they were robbed when it was nominated for an Academy Award. I don't know what won that year, but I think this song should have. And I'm delighted that, as far as I know, it is now the authentic theme song of New York.
Was it different writing for movies than writing for a Broadway show?
Well, both. I've only written for three movies. Two of them were unhappy experiences because the lyrics had to be written so quickly. One of them, I replaced Carolyn Lee, who was supposed to do a movie, and she went into the hospital for what they thought was a minor complaint, and she never came out. And suddenly, they needed a lyricist, so it had to be practically done overnight, and that was no fun. And similarly, the first movie song I wrote was done for The Heartbreak Kid. Elaine May, who directed it, had decided that the last scene of the script was unnecessary. And she had a big fight with Neil Simon, who had written the script. He said, it is necessary. Well, the producers sided with Elaine, and they left out the last scene. So Neil went off to the Caribbean to sulk. And then Elaine thought, well, I think I better have a song. And the assignment that Cy Coleman and I got was impossible. She said, I want you to write a song that will mean one thing when you hear it at the beginning of the movie and something totally different when you hear it at the end. And I said, well, how much time do we have? She said, can I have it tomorrow? It actually took about 2 or 3 days, and maybe that would have been solvable if we'd had time, but we didn't.
So you're not mentioning the name of the song?
Well, it was called the theme from The Heartbreak Kid.
Meanwhile, we have Fiddler on still being performed with Harvey Fierstein and Rosie O'Donnell, giving us a whole different sense of that show than anyone who preceded them, and that has to thrill you. We are going to go out with something from Rent, and we don't have a lot of time to talk about it. Is that something that you also liked?
I think the score to that is remarkable, but I was looking for a simple song, and I found this one.
Sheldon Harnick will be at the 92nd Street Y doing Lyrics and Lyricists. That's the 8th, 9th, and 10th, along with Rob Fisher. For more information, call 212-415-5500. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.